in the world. I'm John Batchelworth. David Davenport and the late Professor Gordon Lloyd's new book, Equality of Opportunity Through the Centuries of the American Experiment, The Vineyard of Liberty. And we come now to a stark declaration by a man who's admired as the most successful president of the 20th century, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I learned from David that at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, May of 1932, in other words, the candidate, Governor Roosevelt, says equality of opportunity no longer exists. What does that mean to him at the time, David?
Well, if I may say, John, when Gordon and I have worked on our books, we like to sit around for a couple, 3 days and debate each other. And Gordon said, well, you know, Franklin Roosevelt said equality of opportunity no longer exists. And I said, no, he didn't say that. Such a stark, bold statement. By way of background, Herbert Hoover's wonderful essay, 1921, American Individualism, sort of gave his philosophy of government, which is American individualism, not European with caste and class, but American individualism, as he always said, coupled with equality of opportunity. So Roosevelt, in this amazing 1932 Commonwealth Club campaign speech, says equality of opportunity as we have known it no longer exists. And to unpack that a bit, what he meant was, if in fact we had equality in previous times, it was because of the availability of open land and people living in an agrarian lifestyle. And he couples individualism with equality of opportunity. But now that we no longer have open land, now that people are living in cities, now that we have an industrial economy run by financial titans, the common man can no longer get equality on his own. He's fighting bigger forces than he is able to take on. And so the government is going to have to step in and create equality of opportunity. So opposite of the founders who said equality is something we start with and we move from, Roosevelt says, no, equality is something we have to move toward, and the government has to lead that charge.
We go to September 1932. He says no longer exists. And then there is speech writing for him informed by a book, Professor Adolph Beryl, Modern Corporations and Private Property, in which these are the early moments of the New Deal identifying the villain, which I said before, Wilson talked the titans of industry. I think Wilson talked about barons. Roosevelt talks about titans destroyed individualism. So he's got a foil. He's got a villain.
Yes.
And he's saying that we must intervene. We progressives must intervene because it's no longer equality of opportunity. The titans of finance are strangling the country, are destroying.
They're taking all the opportunities and leaving nothing for what Roosevelt came to call the forgotten men.
This is Rex Tugwell, Ray Moley, all the heroes here all together. They all saw together, but there's another example that you provide that Roosevelt thought of. We're no longer growing the pie. We must redistribute it. And I was surprised to learn that they believed that the Depression was not temporary. They thought capitalism was defeated.
Yes. It's a little hard when you're trying to go back in history and understand people's motives and deepest thinking. We had assumed that the main line of thinking of the progressives was what we call the Rahm Emanuel School of Public Policy. Never let a good crisis go to waste. It gives you a chance to do things you couldn't do before. So we kind of assumed that what the progressives were thinking was, well, the Depression actually gives us an excuse, an opportunity, a crisis, and we can turn toward progressive ideas more readily in this kind of crisis. But then we discovered the second strain of thinking among Roosevelt's chief economic advisors, that capitalism had sort of run its course. And Roosevelt himself will say in speeches, we don't need more factories and we don't need more businesses. We need to better manage the things that we already have. And of course, Hoover rejects this view that American capitalism is defeated and that there's no growth and no new frontiers still available. So you're right. That's a point of view that we had not really seen until we got into the research. But many of his key economic advisors worried about that prospect. But both of those strains of thought whether using the crisis of the Depression to achieve progressive goals or really feeling like capitalism had come to an end, kind of lead to the same thing, which is a whole progressive overhaul of the role of government in the economy and in social and economic life.
To use the metaphor of medicine, FDR believed that this condition, the fact that capitalism had passed its zenith, needed radical surgery. Hoover said not. He asked the question, this is Halloween, 1932, right before the vote. Do we need to destroy the system that brought us here? He is an optimist, rugged individualism. And at the time, I mean, it's very attractive to us. At the time, I'm presuming they thought he was falsifying, that it didn't exist. It was that gloomy. Is that the way to read this?
Well, yes, and certainly that's how historians have read it. And frankly, Hoover was not a great public speaker. He was not able to project a lot of optimism and confidence in his addresses. And of course, the American people were suffering greatly. I mean, unemployment was vast. And so stay the course, which was the Hoover message. We don't need a radical change in the American system to address an economic emergency was simply not a message that the American people were prepared to hear, particularly when contrasted with kind of the Roosevelt, I feel your pain. Roosevelt himself, by the way, didn't have a lot of specific plans about what to do about the Depression. In fact, in one of his other famous speeches at Oglethorpe College, he says, we basically just need to try something. We need bold experimentation. And so, yes, that then became the caricature of the two candidates, and certainly historians have piled onto that. Now, more recently, there's been a little bit of revisionist history about Hoover, because in a sense, Hoover was following the economic wisdom of the day in dealing with the Great Depression. But of course, Roosevelt had a far sunnier disposition and a more hopeful message, and won the election handily.
The tragedy and the trauma of the assassination of President Kennedy. Lyndon Baines Johnson is now president. I am a Roosevelt New Dealer. The speech, January 8, 1964, which the president declares war on poverty. At this point, where is equality of opportunity in LBJ's mind as he makes that speech?
You know, although Johnson did describe himself as a Roosevelt New Dealer, and he was one of Roosevelt's key leaders in the Congress, you can make the case that Roosevelt's main accomplishment for the forgotten man was Social Security, which, again, you can make the argument is really more a form of insurance. The government is taking your and my money, investing it, and giving it back to us. Johnson thought it was time to be far bolder. And of course, the context of the 60s is far different. We're not in a Great Depression as we were in the 30s, but this was a time when the American economy was really strong. And Johnson thought this was a chance to really accelerate what the government did in the equality field, not so much on regulating business as the early progressives had done, but by enacting social and economic programs to help the disadvantaged. And so as we say in the book, if Roosevelt was in a sense the John the Baptist or the prophet of a bigger government role in equality, then Johnson meant to be the Christ who would come and actually carry it out in a much broader fashion.
Lyndon Baines Johnson, the rhetorician. In May, he names the Great Society, May of 64, yep, for the first time. And the University of Michigan speech later on that month, he fills in what he has in mind, which is creative federalism. It's all high-flown rhetoric, but we come now to some of the challenges. The Howard University speech, June of 65, a year later, passing a lot of legislation early on in 64. He was a master of the Congress to get these things passed. He writes, and here is a mystery, David. The president says, we seek not just legal equity, but human ability, not just equality as a right and a theory. What's he talking about? But equality as a fact and a result. Therein lies the mystery, David.
Indeed, John. I mean, by this time, legal equality was largely established. Now, since Johnson's time, we've continued to refine legal equality. And frankly, by now, the Supreme Court is doing more of that than anyone else. But it's one thing to declare legal equality. And as Johnson said, it's another thing for people to actually experience equality. And so his view was that while not giving up on advances in legal equality, it was time to move towards social and economic equality. And that became really the theme of his administration: wars on poverty, the welfare program greatly expanded, especially aimed at African Americans, who he thought had been left behind in the booming economy of the 1960s. And so Johnson's concern was a little less legal equality and more concerned with economic and social equality, and what could government do to accomplish that. And if I may add, you're exactly right that Howard speech is really difficult to figure out. Some scholars have said, well, clearly Johnson was moving America from equality of opportunity to equality of results, equality of outcome. That's what he wants. We're not as convinced of that, because it seemed to us that Johnson still felt limited by equality of opportunity and American liberty and individualism. We think that he was more likely looking at outcome and results to decide whether equality of opportunity existed. But that's a worthwhile debate that took place because of the way he framed that speech at Howard University.
The programs that follow, the war on poverty is the big title. But for example, yeah. Sergeant Shriver, who was the Peace Corps under Kennedy, stays on, and he becomes the Office of Economic, the Economic Opportunity Act. The economic office. What is his job? To spend money?
Well, yes, although Johnson made it clear to Shriver and others that my programs are not going to be handouts of money. We're not doing the dole here, but we are creating opportunity. So the job of Shriver and Johnson's other advisors was to use education, to use Job Training Corps, which they created, to use all of these things as a way to create opportunities for people who had been left behind. That's one reason we are less convinced than some others that Johnson was moving away from equality of opportunity, because his investment was not going to be just in direct cash payments, but it was going to be creating programs that they thought would lead to greater opportunity for the underprivileged.
At the very least, David, because in reading your book and reading these quotes, there was a confusion at the time as to what Johnson was saying. Was that a problem for them? Did they comment on that at the time? Because these are presidential speeches. They're very carefully constructed. And there's ambiguity in many of these words.
Yeah, the view that made sense to us is that by the time of his Howard University speech, a lot of racial unrest was developing around the country. And our reading of it is that Johnson felt like he needed to get it out in front of that a bit. And so he stretched his rhetoric, we think, in the Howard University speech. But if you look at the actual programs didn't change all that much. And so our view is that he didn't move away from equality of opportunity, but he did look at outcome and results as a way of measuring the lack of success in opportunity and the need for government to do more.
Equality of Opportunity, A Century of Debate is the book. David Davenport and Gordon Lloyd. When we come back, Ronald Reagan and today. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Patchen.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.